Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm David Wright of ABC News, and this is On Point. In the news this week, see you in Singapore? Maybe not. North Korea threatens to cancel a planned summit between Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump. The president says we'll just have to wait and see.
I can only say our people are literally dealing with them right now in terms of making arrangements for the meeting.
Special counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation hits the one-year mark. Rudy Giuliani, the president's attorney, says time to wrap it up.
It's been a year. He's gotten 1.4 million documents. He's interviewed 28 witnesses, and he has nothing.
The U.S. opens its new embassy in Jerusalem, sparking bloodshed in Gaza as Israeli security forces open fire on a crowd of Palestinians protesting near the border, killing 60 people.
It is turning into a pretty grim day here in Gaza. There's a steady stream of ambulances coming in. Most of the people being brought in have gunshot wounds to their lower limbs.
A lot to talk about this hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with guests Zach Beauchamp, Paula Reed, and On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. You can join us on air and online. What's your view on the embassy move to Jerusalem? Was that a productive move by the Trump administration or a provocative one? And how about the IDF's use of live ammunition on those protesters in Gaza? Would you like to see an independent investigation? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With us from Washington is Zach Beauchamp. He's a senior writer at Vox covering global affairs. Zach, it's great to have you.
Hey, happy to be here, David.
Also with us from Washington is Paula Reed, legal affairs correspondent for CBS News. Paula, welcome to On Point.
Thanks so much.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beattie joins us too. Hi, Jack.
Hello, David, Paula, and Zach.
Let's start with the North Korea summit. Zach, this whole thing has a kind of seat-of-your-pants quality to it that wasn't there in previous summits. Do you agree?
Yeah, I mean, none of this is the way that things are supposed to operate, right? The American president has never sat down with a North Korean leader. They've certainly never done it with the lack of lower-level contact that's happening in this case. You know, we've had two state visits from Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, well, not formal state visits, but nonetheless visits. But there's been very little planning at the lowest levels of the diplomatic hierarchy, which you normally do to lay the groundwork for these really big deal summits. And so as such, you basically have diplomacy being conducted via press release.
Paula, the president insists that diplomacy is taking place behind the scenes. He says that Kim Jong-un will get strong protections if a deal is reached between the United States and North Korea. Let's give him a quick listen.
We're willing to do a lot, and he's willing to, I think, do a lot also. And I think we'll actually have a good relationship, assuming we have the meeting and assuming something comes of it. And he'll get protections that will be very strong.
What are you hearing, Paula, about what the administration might be doing behind the scenes here?
Well, in the White House, just yesterday, I mean, Kellyanne Conway floated the idea that this summit may not actually even happen on June 12th. And I think to most of us watching this, that was not a terribly big surprise. It seems, again, very unrealistic that the leader of North Korea and President Trump are just going to, you know, show up on this anointed date and come up with some sort of agreement. I don't think it's very surprising that you were seeing this kind of move on the part of North Korea. They say that they're upset about these exercises between South Korea and the U.S., but you also have John Bolton floating the Libya model. And there is some sort of belief that maybe North Korea wants their own concessions, especially after those three Americans were released home. So nobody really seemed terribly surprised that we see them sort of threatening to pull out, and expect a lot more of that in the weeks and perhaps in the months going forward towards a possible likely summit.
I'm confused as to what the White House would consider a success here. Would it be that the summit happens, or the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, as we've heard before, or simply a unilateral disarmament by North Korea?
They've specifically said that they want the complete, total, irreversible denuclearization of the peninsula. But again, it has not really clear what specifically they hope to achieve at the summit. They hope the summit will be just one step on the way towards accomplishing that goal.
And at this point, they might be happy with just the summit, just to get the conversation started.
Yes.
Let's move on to Gaza now and Jerusalem. First of all, this move of the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, long promised during the Trump campaign, long promised by previous administrations, although they never made good on that promise. On purpose, it would seem. President Trump taking a different view, a harder line stance. Jack Beatty, to what degree is that embassy move itself a provocation?
Well, according to Bruce Riedel, the former CIA analyst now at the Brookings Institution, that move, coupled with the pullout of the Iran nuclear deal without a plan B to replace it, these two actions constitute, quote, a recklessness that is frightening. The split-screen coverage of, on the one hand, the carnage in Gaza, on the other hand, the embassy inauguration, which was shown here, was shown throughout the Arab world. And it has really inflamed feeling, apparently. According to a headline in one pan-Arab newspaper, Al Hayat reads, "The Massacre of Trump's Declaration."
And one of the issues is,
you know, they're connecting it causally. It was this that caused. Well, we don't know what caused what, and you can't, when you're talking about Gaza, leave out the role of Hamas in encouraging this kind of thing. Nevertheless, there was the spectacle, and it was followed by quite a remarkable statement by our UN ambassador. She said the Israelis displayed restraint. On one day, 1,700 people were wounded and about 60 killed. She called that restraint. Would it have taxed her moral vocabularies to have said, Israel has the right to defend itself. On the other hand, we urge restraint in the interest of keeping people alive or humanitarianism or whatever. Nothing like that.
We actually have a clip from Nikki Haley's address to the Security Council teed up here. Let's give it a quick listen.
Those who suggest that the Gaza violence has anything to do with the location of the American embassy are sorely mistaken. Rather, the violence comes from those who reject the existence of the State of Israel in any location.
The location is potentially an issue here because, of course, while Israel sees Jerusalem to be its capital, the Palestinians also see East Jerusalem to be their future capital once a Palestinian state is ultimately agreed on, if it's ever agreed on. So both sides claiming the importance of Jerusalem. So the U.S. has held off in the past about moving it and taking it off the table. It's always been part of the final status discussions. It's been one of the last issues to deal with and one of the thorniest issues to deal with in peace. Zach, by moving the embassy, by excusing or not questioning the violence on the Gaza border, is the U.S. Giving Benjamin Netanyahu's government a blank check?
Absolutely. I even wrote a piece this week entitled The Blank Check Approach to Gaza. That's exactly the right metaphor. In the past, the United States had taken a sort of more mediated role. Now, it had been pro-Israel in a way that most other countries have not been, but nonetheless had been willing to condemn Israeli uses of force when necessary. U.S. governments, even Republican ones, have threatened aid to Israel. They've suspended loan guarantees. They've refused to provide military technology, all in situations where Israel was doing something that the United States didn't approve of or it thought might jeopardize peace negotiations or otherwise the sort of stability of the Middle East. The Trump administration has taken a completely different tack. It's actually quite different than anything that even the George W. Bush administration, the most pro-Israel in history prior to the current administration, had done by virtue of just saying, you know, this is all Hamas's fault. We have no responsibility. The Israelis have no responsibility. It is all on them. They're essentially telling Netanyahu that he can do whatever he'd like and won't face meaningful pressure. He won't face meaningful diplomatic pressure because the U.S. will veto any U.N. Security Council resolutions. And he won't face any pressure from his most important ally, the one that provides him with significant amounts of military aid and has a huge amount of political leverage over his government. So they're not going to be forced to make any concessions for peace. Netanyahu's government is the furthest right in modern Israeli history. They have a great deal of latitude to respond to protests and demonstrations in the way they're doing right now.
this is an issue, of course, that strikes people, gets people's passions up on both sides. And we've got a lot of callers eager to weigh in. Let's hear from Jack calling from Youngstown, Ohio. Hi, Jack.
Hello. I really kind of disgusted with the coverage of what we saw with our own eyes while the media was calling these clashes. These were not clashes between equal people. These were against unarmed, helpless people being shot with telescopic long-distance rifles from far away in fortified positions who were just cut down like dogs. So to call that clashes is a lie, and to use the term so many died, they didn't die from old age or bad health. They died from deliberate slaughter. And I think the media has to take some blame for this. And on the question of North Korea, you know, we know that the situation is that even Bolton, this dangerous man at the ear of Trump, said that they were going to try to use the Libya model, which was to promise that they would allow aid to Libya if they gave up their infant nuclear program. They did, and for that they were told, thank you, sucker, and were destroyed, and their president was horribly tortured to death. So I think we've got to realize that the media is largely the problem in not presenting some of these balancing pictures, because North Korea was destroyed in the Korean War, and every day they're threatened with huge military operations outside their borders. Ooh. To repeat that.
We got it, Jack. Thank you very much for the call and the comment. There are a lot of people that are very upset by watching the violence, the bloodshed on the Gaza border. Israel insists that this was justified. They say that their troops, the IDF troops, were acting in self-defense, and that Hamas militants were planting improvised explosive devices near that border. That said, Israel has declined to have an independent investigation, and they've gotten the U.S. on board with that. That was the issue before the Security Council, vetoed by the U.S. We are talking about this week's top news stories. You can join the conversation. How long should Robert Mueller's investigation go on? Should the scope be unlimited? Or should it be limited to the issue of Russian meddling? The Mueller investigation hits the two-year mark. We'll be talking about that next. I'm David Wright, and this is On Point.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to this podcast. If you love to find and hear great new music, but you don't know where to start, let All Songs Considered be your guide. It's NPR's weekly music discussion and discovery podcast with tons of new songs and artists to fall in love with. Hear All Songs Considered in the NPR One app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm David Wright. We're talking about this week's top headlines. You can join the conversation. Next up is the Russia scandal and the investigation that surrounds it, bigger than Watergate. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Our roundtable today is Zach Beauchamp of Vox, Paula Reed of CBS News, and our On Point News analyst, Jack Beatty. Let's move on to the Mueller investigation, guys. It hits a big milestone this week, 2 years, entering its second year, rather, 1 year since the Mueller investigation began. Where do we stand, Paula?
Well, at the one-year mark, yesterday the president marked the occasion by tweeting once again that he believes that this is a witch hunt. But Mueller, at the same time, he was calling new witnesses before the grand jury, suggesting that we may get another indictment soon. That really tells you all you need to know about the two sides of this case. And while the president likes to call this a witch hunt, Giuliani was making the rounds yesterday on cable news, also kind of doubling down on the idea that this is a witch hunt, that he's not coming up with anything. The fact is that Mueller has charged 19 people, three businesses, with over 100 different counts, from crimes ranging from lying to conspiracy against the United States. So that's a lot of witches, if you want to call this a witch hunt. And the fact is that five of those people are actively cooperating with investigators. They have pleaded guilty and they are cooperating, or they have just pleaded guilty. So that's a pretty good yield for a year. When I talk to other folks who have worked on previous investigations, Whitewater and other similar investigations, they say this is moving at a very swift pace, and the yield is impressive.
Giuliani also said that he's been reassured by the special counsel that Mueller will not indict the president if he finds any wrongdoing, that he would follow the Justice Department's belief that you can't prosecute a sitting president. Should we take him at his word?
Well, it's interesting because I actually spoke with Mr. Giuliani about this a couple days ago, and he told me, he recounted his conversation with special counsel, and it's very interesting, the timeline here, because a couple weeks ago, he spoke with Mr. Mueller, they're having a back and forth, and Giuliani said, well, it's not like you can indict him, and apparently Mr. Mueller said, well, I'm not so sure about that. A couple days later, Giuliani gets a memo from one of Mueller's assistants saying, look, we have decided we are going to abide by this internal memo in the Justice Department that says a sitting president cannot be indicted. What's also interesting is Mueller's boss, Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, came out about the same week and publicly just happened to mention in one of his speeches that he, too, thinks the Justice Department should abide by that memo. So it appears that perhaps there was some sort of conference. They all had to get on the same page.
Interesting.
Because ultimately, even if Mueller thinks he can indict a sitting president, every decision that Mueller makes goes through Rod Rosenstein.
That's right. So he's Rosenstein, not an independent counsel. He's a
exactly.
special counsel.
So if Rosenstein believes you can't indict, that's really the opinion that matters the most. And he's on the record publicly.
And we should clarify that even if they don't indict, that doesn't mean he won't be held to account. It would simply fall to Congress to hold him to account in the form of impeachment. Right?
That's right. At the end of all of this, Mueller will issue a full report to Rod Rosenstein. And if he believes there is any evidence of possible criminal wrongdoing on the part of the president, Rosenstein has a choice. He can pass that along to Congress for possible impeachment proceedings, or he can stick it in a drawer and do nothing. And ultimately, we don't know if that final report will be made public.
That's right. And all of this is one big if, you know, if they find wrongdoing on the part of Trump. And if there is grounds for such a thing, we don't know any of that. But the idea that this whole thing is bigger than Watergate became a thing this week. Zach, the president himself said so, but not talking specifically about the Mueller part of it, right?
Yes. He believes that the investigation into him is a worse scandal than Watergate, which is not how I would frame it. I mean, look, if you think about Watergate, you know, the inciting event, the break-in at the Democratic National Convention headquarters, the Watergate Hotel, what that was essentially operatives for the president going in and stealing Democratic documents. That is what Russia did. In this election, they stole.
They did it electronically, though.
Yeah, right. So the question is, to distinguish between this and Watergate, was there some kind of active participation by the Republican Party or the Republican candidate in the virtual break-in? If there was, it really obviously is bigger than Watergate because it's Watergate plus
a foreign
interference in the U.S. election.
Right, right. And a foreign power doing so, not just dirty tricks within political parties, but some outside player coming in and meddling. This week, the Senate Intelligence Committee, I should say, clarified that they believe Russia did meddle. That was not the finding of the House Intelligence Committee. There seems to be pretty much consensus that Russia did meddle. The question was there collusion?
That's right. And the question then becomes, how do you define collusion? Because on one definition, the Trump Tower meeting where Donald Trump Jr. sat down with the explicit purpose of getting Russian information on Hillary Clinton, that was collusion. Right. Like that could just be collusion on its own. But it's what we're looking for, or what it seems like the sort of holy grail smoking gun thing would be something deeper, would be some kind of Trump campaign involvement and active planning with what Russia ended up doing. We don't know. And it's possible that more information will come to light on this, but we don't know that the Trump Tower meeting led to anything.
And we got right a lot now, more information about that meeting this week with a document dump from the Senate Judiciary Committee of their interviews with several of the key witnesses who were at that meeting. What did we learn? Smoking gun or no? No.
No smoking gun yet. However, there are a number of different details that are really interesting about this. The one that sticks out in my mind and that I just can't stop thinking about is this email that was sent from or to Ika Kavalzadeh, one of the participants on the Russian side in the meeting. And it came right after Donald Trump Jr. published the emails leading up to the meeting on Twitter, which he did for some reason. And the text of the email is something I'm paraphrasing here, but it's something like, why did he just admit to collusion? Ooh. Now, the person who sent that email is blacked out. We don't know who it is. And I'm fascinated by who would send that email to Ike and why they would send an email that essentially says that this meeting constituted in their mind collusion. I have no idea, but just the very existence of an email like this raises so many different investigative questions for someone like Mueller to probe.
Sure. This whole thing is certainly growing about as big as the Warren Commission at some point. We got a lot of callers on the line. Let's get to some of them. Kata is calling from Belmont, Massachusetts. Kata?
Hi. My fear is that both the media and the public will lose interest in this, or that somehow the investigation will be quashed. And I hope that does not happen, because I feel it. There's so much smoke, there's got to be a fire.
Thanks for the comment, Kata. Appreciate it. Let's go to Karen calling from New Orleans. Hi, Karen.
Hi, David. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you. Thanks for the call. What are your thoughts on the Mueller investigation and the one-year mark?
I think that the fact of pursuing justice has to go wherever it leads. What if there were, for instance, murder or, sex trafficking or, just really horrific things? I mean, at what point would we expect the Mueller team to turn back?
So you say keep going.
I say take it until we find out the truth on all of it. Yeah.
All right. Thanks very much for the comment. David from Oklahoma City, what are your thoughts?
Hi, David. I find it absurd that the GOP are demanding, that this get wrapped up when Benghazi went on for 4 years. Hillary was under oath in a public setting to just a Spanish Inquisition type drill, and zero indictments. In 1 year, Mueller has 23 indictments. This is in its infancy stage.
All right. So a lot of our callers, all of our callers there, having a lot of patience with this thing, eager to see it brought to its natural conclusion. But Jack Beatty, I wonder, at some point this does, this kind of investigation makes it very difficult for the administration to get anything done for many other issues to be on the table, doesn't it?
Well, it does, and that's an argument the administration makes occasionally. You know, this is distracting us from the business of the country. And certainly it obsesses people in the White House. The president, according to the Washington Post, as much as 20 times a day has alluded to the raid on Michael Cohen's, the seizure of Michael Cohen's records. He's 20 times in one day, he just kept coming back to this. So he's obsessed with it. The sheer quantity of it, a caller from Belmont raised this question, it gets in the way of even seeing put it another way, the trees make it hard to see the forest. David Frum, a week after the election, I think put it well in a sentence. He said, the controversies will divert you from the scandals. And so it is. I mean, this week we have the revelations about,
yes, to
me,
about to
the revelation about the Don Jr. meeting is the two block numbers that he calls. He makes two phone calls, one before the meeting, I think maybe perhaps a day or two before, and the other one after the meeting to a block number. He says, I don't remember who that was. Well, was that the president? We don't know. We know he has such a number. And does this put Don Jr. in some legal jeopardy? It could. If you say you don't remember, and it turns out you should have remembered and you really were remembering, that's perjury. And H.L. Haldeman in the Watergate matter was found guilty of perjury for similar liberties with the truth. That's one scandal.
Sure. I thought you were going to raise a different scandal, which is came out, a new detail at least, came out in this week's financial disclosure from the president. A significant item in the footnotes there, the disclosure that he paid more than $100,001 to his personal lawyer, Michael Cohen. Paula, why is that significant?
Well, it's significant because this confirms that the president did indeed reimburse his personal attorney for an amount up to $250,000. And while the forms do not specifically say that that was to reimburse Cohen for the hush money that he paid to adult film star Stormy Daniels, Rudy Giuliani has sort of connected those dots for us. He has come out and said, he said a couple weeks ago, he kind of scooped the financial disclosure form. He said, oh, yes, 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 he did reimburse him. It was part of a retainer. But he keeps trying to hammer home.
And the fact that the footnote suggests
this is a Cohen expense. Yep.
The fact that the footnote suggests that it's somewhere between $100,000 and $250,000, might we conclude from that that there are more payments?
There could be. I mean, Michael Avenatti came out yesterday. He says he has at least two more women who were paid hush money. If you look at all the facts of this case, how many women did sort of enter into these non-disclosure agreements, it would not be shocking to know that there were other extramarital affairs, women who entered into these sort of hush money agreements. And there's nothing illegal about paying someone not to speak about an extramarital affair, but it's how they've gone about it and how they didn't disclose it and how the money was coming out of the same fund where hundreds of thousands, almost billions of dollars are coming in from corporations, including a company with close ties to a Russian oligarch. So this financial disclosure form, it does confirm the payment, but it really just opens up so many more questions. Most of them are serious legal questions.
Larry is calling from Detroit, Michigan. Hi, Larry.
Hello, David. My question is, and the previous speaker just mentioned that there's no legal laws that have, there's no laws that have been broken here from a collusion perspective, that there's no legal term for collusion. There's no law that's broken from collusion. There's no law broken in entering into a contract with someone to not disclose whatever information, whether it's of a personal nature or corporate information. I think we're grasping for straws here. And I have to ask how your callers and your guests feel about what if Mueller comes back and says, we discovered that the Clinton campaign committed some illegal acts here in processing data and how they collected this information and submitted it. Are they going to be as happy to see charges placed at that point as they are to see Trump just relentlessly pounded about nothing? The Mueller campaign hasn't found any significant information.
Well, they're not done yet, though. So. They do have several scalps, and they do have several convictions, and they have other indictments. They have not done with their investigation. We don't know yet, do we?
And, well, we don't, but granted that there's a million some documents that are being reviewed in emails and texts. However, the charges that have been brought are not related to this. They're campaign lobbying violations from 10 years ago. There's nothing that's been specific to dealing with Russia during the campaign in 2015 or 16 or...
Well, there is stuff about Russia, but there's not stuff linking Russia and the Trump campaign as conspiring together.
Exactly. And we have Comey coming out saying that he did violate the FBI rules and he violated federal law by disclosing information to his friend, the professor, in order to force this. So we have there's a lot of dirty fruit here. You know,
bottom line, I think what I'm hearing is that your patience with all this is wearing thin and you think that this should be wrapped up and we should move on.
I think that they got to find something that's a legal issue and not a questionable handling of a matter.
All right. Thanks very much for the call, Larry. We need to move on. Let's hear from Randy in Marshalltown, Iowa. Randy, welcome to On Point.
Yes. Hello, David. My comment is, you know, with Rudy Giuliani's statement, it's understandable as Trump's lawyer that he would do anything to protect his client. But for him to say that this investigation has produced nothing in a year, laughable with all the indictments, with critical people at the top of the administration admitting lying to the FBI. It's just laughable that he would say that. However, my concern is, like with other things that President Trump says and his supporters, as they lie and over and over and over again, it seems like the public starts to believe it and gets tired and tunes to something else. So my concern is that
you're worried about investigation fatigue and apathy and cynicism from the voters who would then perhaps simply move on and say, well, we accept some alternative facts.
All of the above, yes.
Yeah. Thanks so much for the call, Randy. A reasonable concern, Jack Beatty?
It is indeed a reasonable concern. However, that picture of fatigue, it hasn't set in, apparently, even among Trump supporters. There was a...
a focus group, I think in Wisconsin recently, with a group of Trump voters, and they were critical of the investigation, but they also felt firing Mueller would be a red line. I mean, there was a strong feeling that that would be wrong for the president to do, and this is even from people who were supporting him. So even if they have some fatigue and some ennui with the pace of the investigation, that group, that focus group anyway, was saying, don't fire him.
Interesting. And he's not done yet. We're discussing the weekend news. You can join the conversation. Up next, has Gina Haspel, Trump's pick to head the CIA, atoned enough for enhanced interrogation methods the CIA used during the Bush administration? I'm David Wright, and this is On Point.
I'm Ophira Eisenberg. Join me on NPR's Ask Me Another as we challenge contestants and celebrities to nerdy word games, music parodies, and ponderful trivia. Find us every week on the NPR One app and wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm David Wright. In other news this week, in memoriam, actress Margot Kidder passed away Sunday. She was 69 years old. Here she is with Christopher Reeve in Superman, Lois Lane's first exclusive sit-down interview with Superman.
Just how fast do you fly, by the way?
Oh, I don't know, really. No, never actually, bothered to time myself.
No?
Say, why don't we find out?
And how do you propose we do that?
Take a ride with me?
Author Tom Wolfe, one of the pioneers of new journalism, died Monday at the age of 88. He was the author of The Right Stuff, The Bonfire of the Vanities, and so many other great books. Here he is in an interview with CBS in 2006.
I read the article, and then essentially it said, what a colorful man, he wears white suits. I realized I had a substitute for a personality. And still do. I mean, these white suits have been worth their weight in gold.
Also, the latest meme to test your senses. Give a listen to this clip. What do you hear? Jimmy Kimmel put this internet meme to his viewers.
This country, maybe not even just this country, much of the English-speaking world has been torn in two over the past 48 hours by this.
Laurel. 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 Laurel.
So I'm looking for a one-word answer from each of my panelists here. Paula Reed of CBS, Zach Beauchamp of Vox, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. What do you hear in that clip?
Laurel.
Yanny.
I hear Kofifi.
Yeah, I was going to say, you stole my answer.
Very interesting. I actually hear Laurel, so put me down for Laurel. You can join the conversation, too. Did the media overreact when the president called some illegal immigrants animals? Has Trump's pick to head the CIA satisfied your concerns about enhanced interrogations of terror suspects during the war on terror? Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. So let's turn now to Gina Haspel. Mitch McConnell praised her as the ideal person to lead the CIA.
Gina Haspel is the right woman at the right time. Her nomination has support from national security leaders and senators in both parties.
There's no question she has a great deal of experience and respect within the agency. However, she's been tarnished by her association with those intense interrogation methods that were authorized during the Bush administration and which were championed by President Trump on the campaign trail. Paula, do you see her as being able to ride this out?
Well, clearly she has.
Yeah, I mean, she's
there. Clearly she wouldn't really directly answer the question or atone for that during her hearing. But it seems her subsequent letter that she sent out, sort of saying we had learned the lessons from 9/11 and we don't want to repeat them, that seemed to be sufficient atonement to at least get her the vote that she needed. What's interesting about this to me, in addition to the torture debate, though, is this is kind of a win for a career government official, right? There's so much in the Trump administration that's about draining the swamp.
And the deep state.
Exactly, the deep state, yes. Perhaps she's part of the deep state, I don't know. But there's so much about the conversation right now that's about, is sort of coming down really hard on people who have given their lives, decades of their lives, to public service. So it's interesting here, she had the support of the rank and file, and this is someone who has spent decades in government, in the CIA. And for her to win this vote and to get this position, it's significant because you look around at so many other people right now in top law enforcement positions, with the exception of the attorney general, and most of them are not of a similar ilk.
Yeah. Jim is on the line from Cleveland, Ohio, to weigh in on this. Jim, what are your thoughts?
Hi, David. How's it going?
Well, thanks.
I call all the senators, the Democratic senators that were swayed by her individually, Heitkamp, Warner, Manchin, I forget the other three, but I call all their offices because I'm very concerned about her nomination. And when I talk to each one of their staff members said, you know, kind of to a person, the reason that they were swayed and they're going to now vote for her was because in private session or whatever they call that after session and in discussion of confidential materials, you know, in other meetings, you know, just for the Senate Intelligence Committee, they were convinced by what she said to them that she would not do this stuff again. But my problem with that is she said nothing in public session. So we're supposed to assume that Mark Warner, Joe Manchin, Heidi Heitkamp et al. Know what's right. And yet she didn't say anything in this public hearing. So I'm really concerned that what does this say to the world when we nominate and allow someone like this who ran a secret torture camp in Thailand and destroyed the tapes? We say, you know what, this person's okay. We never, you know, you all are spending all this time on the Mueller investigation. I wish we'd spent this much time on torture because that's really what needed all this attention. We're spending all this time on, you know, Russia and Mueller and all and Hillary Clinton in the 2016 election. But the real problem here is we're just letting this go by. And
we should clarify, though, that this was enhanced interrogation, a.k.a. torture, that occurred during the Bush administration. It's since been the agency itself has distanced itself from it. The U.S. government has distanced itself from it, widely seen to be an embarrassment and a mistake. Even though the president has said on the campaign trail that he's all for it if it leads to good information and makes America safer. Jim, we'll take that thought from you, but I want to move on to Peter from Boston, Massachusetts. Peter, your thoughts?
Yeah, Dave. Listen, I voted for Trump, and I've got a lot of problems with some of the things he's done, but this CIA appointment, who has been appointed, I just think she's an amazing, in this day and age, just an amazingly qualified person. It broke down totally with the Democrats who didn't like Trump, we're against her. I mean, she's well qualified. I happen to be a combat veteran of Vietnam like McCain, and I disagree, although John McCain is a bona fide hero, and I totally understand where he comes on things, but people who are the biggest critics have never been in warfare, and I think with CIA, she's acknowledged some of the things, but you need somebody experienced, you need somebody, again, to put as much pressure to get as much type of information as you can. I think with the parameters that she talked about, I think she's a fantastic choice, and in this day and age where the women's movement, that women are never getting acknowledgments and pushed to the highest level, I think it's kind of interesting that here's one who is totally capable and backed by even the former directors, and now she's criticized, who has acknowledged some of the things, but she's totally qualified, and people want to still throw her under the bus. Thank goodness she's been appointed. We have somebody who knows what they're doing and have experience.
All right. Thanks very much for the call, Peter. Appreciate your perspective on this. Let's turn to another of the president's cabinet that is under fire, facing some tough questions this week, EPA Chief Scott Pruitt. He's been embroiled in a scandal surrounding ethics and spending decisions. This week, New Mexico Senator Tom Udall took him to task in a committee hearing. Let's give a listen.
You have been treating your position of public trust as a golden ticket for extravagant travel and fine dining, and as a platform to cozy up to media personalities, political donors, and polluters. I'm worried you are spending all your time enriching yourself and your friends while betraying your mission to protect human health and the environment.
Tough talk from Senator Udall there. Zach, I wonder, Mr. Pruitt said this week that he's going to be setting up a legal defense fund. You going to be making a contribution?
No, I don't think I will. Not just because I'm a journalist and I shouldn't do things like that, but also because he's wasting a lot of money on himself, right? This is taxpayer dollars that are being spent on private trips. He has claimed that he needs to sit in first class because people will recognize him and berate him on the planes. And as one of my colleagues said, I'm a professional journalist who covers the White House. I don't think I would recognize Scott Pruitt. Like, he doesn't have a very memorable face, right? This is really just he wants to sit in first class. He wants to do it. Everything the senator was saying was accurate. Now,
he's not alone in the Trump cabinet in that respect. Others have gone so far as to commission private planes.
Right. I mean, there's an endemic sense and blurring of the lines between private and public in the Trump administration. And it starts with the president, right, who is not distanced himself functionally from his own business enterprises and his family-run enterprises and has – there's clear evidence that foreign companies have cozied up to Trump and Kushner family companies because of the president's role. There's money that has been, you know, all the payments to Michael Cohen that we've learned about recently that have come from foreign donors and corporations, all seemingly designed to buy influence with the president and the White House. You know, there's just not a clear division between public and private resources and the way that they're deployed in this White House. And while none of this is as bad as torturing some people, which Gina Haspel seemingly probably did, or at least was complicit in, it is still a betrayal of public trust.
Right. Paula, I wonder, do you see Pruitt surviving this? It seems to be kind of torture to watch.
Well, again, so far, he appears to be surviving it.
I mean, he serves at the president's pleasure, so I suppose the president has to get fed up with him first.
His demise have been greatly exaggerated, and it appears that he is willing to do the president's bidding and put forth some very unpopular policies over there. And as for the legal fund, you know, that's actually become quite fashionable for Washington officials.
And for Trump insiders, yes.
Yeah, I mean, McCabe raised hundreds of thousands of dollars for his legal defense, so I'm sure Pruitt saw that and said, heck, why not?
Right. Lorraine is calling from Tampa, Florida. Lorraine, what are your thoughts on Scott Pruitt?
David, thank you for taking my call. My wonder is why on earth somebody with his history of continually with the EPA, suing the EPA, even considered for appointment as representing the country for as head of the EPA. How does something like that happen? And you know, the hindsight is going and investigating him, but why was he appointed in the first place?
Well, you'd have to ask the president about that, but I think that there are lots, you know, one answer would be that there are lots of unconventional folks joining this administration, and that was part of the point of a lot of people that voted for Donald Trump. They wanted something different.
Different, innovative, alternative are all euphemisms for anti, I think. And so what he's done is just gutted regulations and probably plans to gut a lot more if he survives. It will be following President Trump's example, of course. But it's just I think that it's a bizarre thing for them to consider somebody with that record as representative of the people. I don't understand how he's representing the American people.
All right. Thanks very much for the thought. Lorraine calling from Tampa, Florida there. Last topic that we wanted to address this morning were some remarks from President Trump about undocumented immigrants. This was during a White House meeting on Wednesday. And he lashed out at sanctuary cities. These are cities that look the other way in terms of undocumented immigrants, many of them out in California. And he called some undocumented immigrants animals. He was speaking specifically about transnational gangs like MS-13. Jack Beatty, your thoughts?
Well, I mean, as colonists have dug up, he's used animals, referring to criminals and in minorities generally, especially minority criminals or accused criminals, going way, way back. That seems to be – that dehumanization seems to be one of his default mechanisms. But, you know, he also made a comment about the mayor of Oakland, Libby Schaaf, who warned undocumented immigrants that a raid from ICE was imminent. And he said, Jeff Sessions was there, and he said, Jeff, you ought to look into that. She talk about obstruction of justice. You know, that's a case of a president almost ordering up a political prosecution. And interestingly, The New Yorker reports this week from the head of the ICE office, or the head of publicity at the ICE office in San Francisco, that the agency had projected that they had picked up about 200 people in this raid. And in fact, in the event, they got 232. And Trump has been saying that they were looking out after 1,000. That's not what this man says, that the raid was actually, from their point of view, the ICE point of view, successful, and so that it's kind of a demagogic attack on the mayor for spoiling the raid. They got more people than they expected. That's what this man tells The New Yorker.
Interesting. A lot of callers have thoughts on this. Doug is calling from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Doug, welcome to On Point.
Hi, David. ICE picked up 25 undocumented immigrants in Iowa here recently. I wish that the original media reports would have designated the MS-13 that the president had been talking about. He was not talking about brown-skinned people. He was talking specifically about MS-13, and that just got lost in the shuffle, and it was just the usual after that.
Okay. Thanks for the thought. Nick is calling from Clarksville, Tennessee, with some thoughts. Nick?
Hi, David. How you doing?
Good.
I'm just here to say that, you know, I've seen how Trump, you know, manipulates the media. I think he absolutely meant to be racist with what he said, and he knows that people start talking about it, it's going to give them more chances to sit there and talk about how bad these MS-13 people are, and they're just, and it's a way that they can, you know, like dehumanize, associate, you know, illegal immigrants with these people, like that's the only people that are illegal immigrants out there. And in the actual context, it really wasn't that close to MS-13. He said, we're picking people up, we're sending them back, and these people are, you know, our animals. He didn't say gangers at that time. So, I mean, he intentionally left it very vague so that it would make a bunch of talk so he could get his point through and probably distract us from whatever else. I'll leave it at that.
All right. Thanks very much for the comment, Nick. You know, the president is known for colorful language, and often people are shocked by what he says. But he was talking in this instance specifically about that gang. And shocked or not, this is an issue that he's put forefront in his agenda. I really want to say thank you to our guest today, Paula Reed, legal affairs correspondent for CBS News. It's been great to have you today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Zach Beauchamp, senior writer for Vox, covering global affairs. Thank you so much, too.
I love being on.
Great. And as always, me too. As always, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Have a good weekend, Jack.
Thank you, David.
All right. You can contribute to the conversation or get our On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Brian Hartzinski, Eileen Amada, Stefano Katsonis, Allison Poli, Catherine Proctor, Tanya Rally, James Ross, and Alex Schroeder. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. Coming up Monday, President Trump pushes for prison reform at a White House summit. Congress takes it up too. We'll unpack it. I'm David Wright, and this is On Point.